You're listening to Reality Sandwich Radio, where every Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, body, spirit, and our planet, community, and economy. To learn more about the Healthful Living model, go to healthfulliving.org. Reality Sandwich is hosted by Julie Matthews, Certified Nutrition Consultant, and Martin Matthews, Certified Medical Hypnotherapist. Past episodes of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com. Thanks for listening. Today, Julie, we're going to be speaking about, I don't think there could be a more impactful subject matter than what we'll be speaking about on today's show. We often speak about various areas of holistic health, things that are going on the planet, but there's nothing greater that pervades our lives, brings us more joy, more happiness, and also causes us more pain than the notion of love. And there is nothing greater than love. And we're in a country and in a society and in a time now where this topic is everywhere. Just now, even before we left to come to the show, the topic on Yahoo was something about relationships and how to meet your mate. And we live now where 50% of marriages fail. And it makes me wonder what percentage of relationship attempts fail. Love is the thing that we're all after and that we're all trying to also avoid the pain of. Yet it's something that we truly need to learn how to engage in. Learn about it, what it takes. Today we have the authors of a wonderful new book, Learning to Love, Don and Martha Rosenthal. Julie, tell us a little bit about today's guests, please.
Absolutely. Don and Martha regularly lead workshops on intimacy and relationships, and they do a Don is trained at the Tomales Institute of Psychotherapy under Robert Hall, and he counsels couples and individuals privately, employing psychotherapy as a means for spiritual investigation. And Martha, who studied body and energy work, leads women's meditation retreats and assists individuals, couples, and families in applying spiritual perspectives to their lives. And they live in Vermont in what sounds like a wonderful nature environment. And they have written this wonderful book that we are going to be talking about today.
And just before we bring them on the line, I want to read something from the jacket of the book that I just really just stood out here for me. And it says that when you directly confront the messy imperfections of humanness, happiness, desire, devotion, anger, judgment, and fear, to be present and acknowledge their power, you'll create an atmosphere of emotional safety where feelings can become constructive and enlightening. I love that. Let's bring them on the line. Welcome, Don and Martha.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here today.
I'm looking forward to it. It seems like we're both in long-term married relationships, and it seems like it'll be a really fun, exciting topic today.
Well, you two have many more years on Julie and I. We've been married for 6.5 years now. And behind each of us are, well, Julie's parents are 37 years and mine are coming up on 50. Yeah. So we feel it's tremendously important to share insights with folks. And it sounds like you have some deep, deep knowledge. And I'd like to just begin with this notion of learning to love. It's the first thing I thought when I saw the topic is, my goodness, we really do need to learn to love. So I'd like to just begin by asking you a little bit about why do we need to learn this and some of your story and your background.
Well, I think we need to learn it because when I was young and naive and saw all my friends getting married, I noticed that very quickly it didn't work out to be as happy as they thought. Mm. And you said earlier 50% of marriages fail. Well, I think it's even more than that because some stay together in constant conflict and battle, and some stay together and go dead. So I think that there are some skills required in order to live in harmony with someone who is your equal, which is a fairly new situation in our culture. Mm. And they didn't teach the skills in school. Many of our parents didn't know the skills, how to relate as equals. There were very few wise tribal elders. The religions indicated that it was a really good idea to be loving and kind and forgiving, but they neglected to say how. And the information just wasn't out there. And so most of us, when we entered marriage, found that it was a great deal
hundreds of couples that almost every couple, without exception, has gone down a downward spiral as a result of functioning in the default setting from the unconscious conditioning patterns inherited from their parents or what they see around or within themselves, and that we have not seen a relationship that doesn't have to reclaim itself through conscious work or conscious loving, learning how to love in the midst of chaos, upheaval, disagreements, arguments, and challenges, and stress.
Yet we have such a negative association with conflict, and we tend to feel badly of ourselves when we're in conflict with our partners. Yet it seems such a requisite, unavoidable component.
Yeah, I think that collisions are inevitable in a relationship. It's just that I think we need to learn to do them gracefully and respectfully. And again, we don't have too many role models for that. See, I think that the real challenge in having a good intimacy is, on the one hand, you want to have two people who feel absolutely comfortable to be who they are with all their warts and imperfections.
In each other's presence.
And in each other's presence. And on the other hand, you want to have a feeling of emotional safety. And emotional safety just doesn't flower in the presence of a lot of blame and judgment. So that's the challenge.
Yeah, a lot of our path has to do with cleaning up the communication, of transmuting an anger in which there's blaming into what we call clean anger, where we're simply stating what doesn't work for us without pointing to the flaws of our partner.
And Martha, you were saying that we need to do this in the presence of others or in the presence of our partner. Why is that? Why can't we just do our own thing by ourselves and figure it out that way?
Well, that's a great question, Julie. It's that both Don and I lived in cabins in remote areas of Alaska by ourselves, and none of these issues appeared because we thought we were just meditating, doing a lot of yoga, and everything was great. There were no problems. The relational issues only come up in the presence of another being. And we're here to share tools and approaches that in which one can begin to welcome the conflict as a means to transmuting the unconscious parts of ourselves.
That makes a lot of sense.
And so we have gratitude, actually, for the process that allows us to become more of who we are with and through our partner.
It sounds messy.
Well, I would say, if I were to describe our relationship, it was quite messy around 7 years in. In fact, it was so messy we almost split up. And then when we decided to stay together, we had to use the Braille method to just sort of feel our way into what worked and what didn't work. And I love the place we're in now, 36 years into our marriage. And I think that what's happened is that the messiness began to dissipate over time. And now we'll have occasional moments of disharmony or growling at each other, but it has a twinkle in the eye and it doesn't feel messy anymore.
So is fighting just an inevitable, important part of a relationship? Sometimes I imagine or even see people that claim that they rarely ever fight, and yet I find that we fight, you know, we have some big fights, but I would consider us having a fairly strong relationship. So
well,
how does that?
I think it depends on your definition of the word fight. I would say that I can't imagine two honest, strong people who are equal not having their moments of real non-alignment and disharmony between them. I think that's inevitable. I think whether it's expressed in a way that's respectful to each other or not depends on how conscious they are.
And we've often found that when people come, either in workshops or individually, and they say to us, well, we never fight, what we often find, most often find underneath that is that one or perhaps both of them might be ready to leave the relationship or are sitting on top of a lot of unexpressed anger.
Yeah. Mm.
With a coating of, oh, we get along fine. We've heard so many couples say, people think of us as the perfect couple.
Hmm.
I think some people by nature are conflict phobic,
mm-hmm.
and that's neither good nor bad, but if that's the case, then what happens is that people who are like that will go for surface harmony. And when you go for surface harmony, that usually creates deep down disharmony.
Mm.
Whereas if you allow for surface disharmony and you do it skillfully, then you have the opportunity for deep down harmony.
I love that notion of surface, just the concept of surface harmony being something that pervades us in relationships and in so many walks of life, as and is something that is just clearly not sustainable.
It cannot
be sustainable.
I used to be a classical musician, and I would use the analogy of if a musical piece were nothing but harmony, harmony, harmony without any dissonance in between, it would be boring.
Mm.
Mm.
And it's not realistic on the earth plane.
Right. Is this where you talk in your book about the survival strategies of niceness, withdrawal, and aggressive behavior? Is this part of that?
I think people have different temperaments in dealing with their fear or discomfort, and also they're taught by their parents. So the combination of genes and upbringing causes people to deal with their discomfort either by attacking, getting angry, blaming and making others wrong, or by pulling back and hiding behind a wall and becoming emotionally unavailable, or by pasting a smile on top of the pain, pretending everything is okay. And there can be combinations of those, too.
Sure.
So let's just speak a little bit, just briefly here, about the book and also this show, who this goes out to as far as folks that are, you know, desiring relationships, in relationships, struggling in them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
All of the above.
Yeah.
People considering relationships, people even who have parented children together and are separated or divorced or with other partners, but who will have a lifelong relationship with their former partner based on the children. And so we feel like it is in everyone's best interest, regardless of where they fall on the spectrum, to take their relationships more seriously.
Mm.
I see relationship really as an art form, that the life we create together in our home is really like a work of art. It takes place over time, like music and dance. And it's like sculpture, you chip away continually at what doesn't belong to leave the thing in its glory. And a good artist will get better at his or her craft through the years, so that even if the relationship feels good, you can learn to do it better.
Yeah.
And it's my lifetime interest to learn how to become more skillful at this wonderful art. Because, you know, you can be good at many things, but that doesn't make you happy, whereas being good at loving someone really does tend to make you happy.
Mm.
And
I feel that we take on relationship as it being totally in alignment of why we're here on the planet, which Don and I and many others see as learning how to love more unconditionally. So who are we in a better position to learn with and from than our partner to expand our hearts where it's the hardest in many cases.
Mm.
And as you mentioned there, Don, like a skilled artist who chips away at the outer parts of the stone in order to emerge the beautiful sculptor inside, they have to have a very clear vision of what that is, of what it is that they're aiming to create and what they feel that is. And
yeah, I see what you're saying. I think that's true. I would say it's I'm not clear necessarily what the form is going to look like, but I am clear that I'm moving towards expressing my love unconditionally.
Sure.
Because, you know, just think, most people who are listening to this, if your partner is loving you, it's pretty easy to love them back. And most of the love we offer is conditional love, which is I'll love you if you behave the way I want.
Mm-hmm.
But think of your partner entering the room in a bad mood and snapping at you and criticizing you unfairly, it's much harder to return non-love with love. even though all the great spiritual traditions say it's a wonderful idea, anyone who's tried knows it's the challenge of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my the vision of my sculpture, is to be able to do that.
On that point, your book is so full of chock powerful insights that just really, I mean, I could just think about for hours. One of which is here on page 32 of Learning to Love, about
That's
a new...
very synchronous, because I'm open to page 32.
a new purpose in being together.
Yeah.
I'm just going to read this briefly so listeners can really take this in, if you don't mind. The process involves a fundamental shift in the relationship's center of gravity. No longer is the purpose in being together simply the serving of our individual needs. Our relationship is no longer a bargain of convenience. Rather, here's the powerful part, our joint purpose is to find the truth of who we really are by bringing compassion, awareness, and honesty into every aspect of our relationship and our daily life.
Yes.
And that finding the truth of who we really are, I don't think is something that we commonly give prime consideration to when we enter into a relationship.
No, most of us enter in the back door. On a romantic basis, we fall in love, and we're given that view of our partner, actually through grace, of seeing them in their highest or their fullest or their wholest. And then, after some time, that falls away and the real work begins. And that's when we, well, better yet at the beginning, though, but at least when that falls away, that if we don't share a common vision and purpose, then it's simply a process of degeneration.
And I might add that what the book is really talking about is our vision of intimacy as a spiritual path.
Hmm.
And we're not trying to sell a particular teaching or path, but just that there is something that we all long for, and you could call it unconditional love, you could call it the connection with the source, you could call it finding out who we really are, and we know it feels good, and that there's stuff in the way for all of us. And I think nothing brings up the obstacles more swiftly and efficiently than being in relationship with an equal partner. And, I think that what gets in the way of learning from that is our tendency to blame our partner for not loving us enough, to start resenting our partner. And I think what happens is, after the early romantic stage is over, in most relationships, resentment sets in, and it serves to lessen the amount of love that comes through, and then our partner resents us for our resentment, and it starts going down a very predictable downward spiral as each person resents the other person for their resentment. And it's, of course, it's impossible to learn from the difficult moments if you're blaming them on your partner.
Mm.
And I think this all really stems from looking to our partner as the source of love, as opposed to what you said, Martin, finding out the truth of who we are, which is love, and then from that place sharing that with our partner.
Hmm.
It's a fundamental shift in looking at where the source of love is coming from.
I believe you mentioned earlier that we come into relationships with all kinds of preconceived notions and programming from having observed our parents and other relationships in society, and therefore we're bringing all kinds of baggage in and all kinds of expectations about how to engage. I've often looked at entering a relationship as playing a card game, where we keep so many of the cards behind our back and hope to play with only a few of them, and hope that the other person will put more of their cards out on the table first so that we can better assess the game and determine if we want to play more of our own cards. And certainly gender programming, plays a lot of that as well. Men, to be sure, have, their own issues about what we feel a relationship should be like. So I'd like you to speak a little bit about if there's any other preconceived notions that we have, or really just some guidance to help our thought process, even before we go in.
Yeah, I would say that what helped me the most in getting past my own conditioning, which was sizable, was learning how to listen when Martha was bothered by my behavior, to listen to her without defensiveness, because these are the opportunities to learn about my unconsciousness and unskillfulness when Martha is bothered by what I do. But you know as well as I that normally what happens in a relationship is if your partner comes and says, I'm angry at what you said or I'm hurt by what you did, most of us will get defensive. We'll either justify our behavior or withdraw or attack them for being even worse or have an emotional meltdown. And in all those cases, the person being defensive can't hear their partner and learn the beautiful lesson inherent in the interchange.
Why is that? I know that I was reading a part in your book about pain and how uncomfortable it is for us to either see our partner, experience our partner's pain or experience our own pain. And I'm wondering if this is part of what you're speaking of.
Oh, absolutely. We have been so conditioned. We're hardwired to move away from pain and to be interested in where the pain is arising from and being with it. This is what we call a shift in the purpose of relationship.
I would say that to the extent that I'm comfortable with my own pain, I can be there for my partner's pain without being uncomfortable. Very often, if our partner is in pain, and I think this is especially true for men, we almost resent them for feeling bad. We feel it's our fault. And even if we come to them with seeming compassion, what we're really saying is, I want you to stop feeling bad so I can feel good. And I think that the old ways of responding to pain don't work really well.
I have to share this personal example that when Don and I came together, each of us had come from families in which anger was never ever expressed directly. It took us 10 years. And this was our relationship beginning around 1970, for us to feel safe enough to bring it out. And when I look back and I see what my anger looked and felt like it was coming out of a rusty pipe. It was very raw. It was totally blaming. And at the same time, Don realized out of his love for me how necessary this was for my own process. And when he stayed there when I'd be yelling at him with all my veins sticking out in my neck, and he stayed there, something in me began to melt, and the anger started to dissipate. And it was one of the largest gifts I've ever received.
Wow. You talk in the book about being comfortable is no longer our goal. Instead, our purpose is to help each other unearth our essence and work through anything that might be blocking its full expression. I just think that's... what we all want.
Yeah, if I were to say it now, I would say there's such a thing as deep comfort, again, which is really like peace. And I would say the superficial comfort is no longer my goal. Mm-hmm. I'm willing for Martha to be angry at me. And I might add to what Martha said, I think learning to be present for each other's anger without getting defensive, without fighting back, without leaving, is one of the more challenging things that I've ever done in my life. But I think there has to be room for anger as long as it's expressed cleanly and respectfully in a relationship, because otherwise that anger will go inside and
create disease.
It can create disease, it can create depression, it can create all kinds of problems.
So let's talk a little bit about what some of these sources of pain are, which I'm sure there are many. You mentioned in the book that virtually everything painful between you and your partner has some relationship to childhood wounds of both parties. So maybe can you talk some about that?
Sure. We wrote the book a number of years ago, and probably I would add something now that I didn't say then. I think childhood wounds exacerbate the nature of pain, but I don't think they're necessarily the cause of it. I notice that when I'm feeling really deeply good about myself, I don't have pain in relationships. I can give you an example that might make sense to some of your listeners. You have a little child who's in a bad mood, and you offer the child love, and the child just pushes you away and doesn't return your love, and yet you don't feel pain or sadness or hurt or anything. You just say, oh, he's in a bad mood. I'll love him by leaving him alone for a while. And yet you go to your partner and offer them love, and they push you away, and then you feel hurt. Mm-hmm. And if someone says, why are you hurt? You'd say, well, because they pushed me away. They rejected me. And I would say, no, the reason I'm hurt is because I took offense at their rejecting me. Mm-hmm. I didn't take offense when my child rejected me. Therefore, I didn't feel pain. And so what I've come to see is that the real source of pain in relationship is what I'm doing inside my own consciousness, the way I'm responding to non-love in the other person. And I think it's usually some form or another of taking offense at that.
Hmm.
And if I didn't take offense at the other's non-love, I don't think I would experience pain.
Don and I have a mantra that we've used recently in the last few months, and it goes like this. I can be happy even when, and I could say, even when Don is not cleaning the counters, even when Don is
being unloving.
And we practice that.
What I find is, on that notion, is that being unhappy takes work. Being angry takes work.
Yeah.
It does take work, although the work goes on unconsciously. So my partner will act unloving to me, and I'll respond by being unhappy, and I will believe they did it to me.
Mm.
So therefore, I would say one of the major themes of our book and our work is to explore this notion that when I'm feeling bad, it's not my partner that does it to me. And, you know, I say this with some trepidation because I know it's such a common New Age thing to say, oh, yes, I'm responsible for my own feelings. But I don't think people really believe that, because I think if one believed that, why would anyone resent their partner if they knew they were responsible for their own feelings? I think we resent somebody because we think the other person caused us suffering.
Which doesn't mean we can't bring to our partner's attention stuff that they do that doesn't work for us. But there's a difference between that and actually holding that against them.
So this has been one of the major themes for me, that it's harder and harder for me to blame Martha for anything when I'm feeling bad, because I can see when I'm in a loving state, I feel good, not bad, and that there's no one out there I've ever found who has the power to make me close my heart. That's an inside job.
I have so many comments just now in my mind. I mean, it's that broader notion. I mean, we have to do work to go into somebody else's head to try to come up with a story that it was their intention to hurt us. And that's, you know, it's like digging and knitting and picking. And when we really stop and think about it, which we don't typically do in that moment, there's no rationale for that.
Generally speaking, I think, I'll give you a good example of that.
Sure.
When someone lies, people often take, when their partner lies to them, they take it personally, as if their partner lied in an attempt to hurt them. Whereas in my experience, people usually lie because they feel guilty.
Hmm.
And they're trying to sort of mitigate the feeling of guilt. So most of the time, I would say it's not true that your partner's trying to hurt you. But occasionally, I've noticed when I felt Martha hurt me, my ego isn't very nice. And I would say something to Martha where, when I looked honestly, my purpose in saying it was to hurt her. But the point is that she has to accept that hurt. My child might call me a poo-poo head because I don't let him have a second portion of cake. And he's trying to make me feel bad. But if I don't feel take it personally and get insulted, then I'm okay with that.
Hmm.
Right. We both love our parents dearly, and we realize that they've both had very, very long-term relationships and are both couples are still married. Yet there's things about them personally and even in their respective relationships that we don't like and that we know that we do not want to repeat those particular patterns. And we can see that there are things that we have each just picked up from our parents that sometimes, given a context, circumstance, whatever, will plop right into ours. And we've learned that we can not take offense to each other if we point that out to one another.
Yeah. Julie, depends, of course, on the way you point it out.
Right.
If you say harshly, "You're being just like your mother," that's not very effective.
But we actually have a tool that we share that has really worked for us and worked for a lot of other people. And one of the main ways that our parents come through us unconsciously is with our tone of voice when we're speaking to one another. So that if either one of us hears the other saying something from that place, quote-unquote, we'll say, "Would you run that by again?" And then the person who spoke just gets to replay the tape and hear the tone of their voice, and that it most likely was not very loving, and then just say the same thing again, but gather themselves and allow what they want to say to their partner.
The only thing about this little structure we do is that we have a very, very firm commitment that when the other asks us, "Would you run that by again?" not to get defensive. And I've learned so much from this one thing about my own unconscious habits of negativity, about the fact that I much more frequently than I would have cared to admit use the tone of voice that I wouldn't want to be talked to. And so now, as a result of having done this with each other thousands of times over the years, when I'm about to speak, there's something that sort of hears what it's going to sound like to Martha before I say it. And frequently I choose not to say it, or I say it in a different way.
So I just want to talk a little bit before we get to some of the how can we work with some of this and what are some ways to help couples out. But before that, I just want to talk a little bit about since the childhood pain piece is so big, and I work a lot with pregnant women, and, you know, I do a lot with really encouraging natural birth and all those wonderful ways of supporting a woman and listening to their intuition and empowering them and all those wonderful things. And that was not the way that most of us were brought into the world way back. And I would love for you to just describe what you described in your book a little bit in terms of how just even something simple like our model for birth in the hospital in the particular way that it was done, especially 20, 40 years ago, and even today, it really plays a factor on someone's pain, and we don't even realize it.
Yeah, I was,
hugely.
I was born 69 years ago, and the tradition then was to take the baby away from the mother
immediately,
and put it in a nursery surrounded by other screaming babies in bright lights. So it must have been like some form of insane asylum, some hell. And then every few hours, I'd be brought to my mother for a short period of time and then taken away again. And this lasted the first week of my life. When I look upon it, I feel that there was a kind of insanity going on. And it certainly could not have contributed to any kind of initial feeling of safety and security in the young one. And so I get something to do battle with and to talk to my therapist about and to deal with now. And with our son, we had him at home, and, of course, we tried as much as possible to avoid these mistakes. But I think those of us who were born and brought up in those conditions have an extra piece of conditioning and baggage to deal with.
It's just disturbing to think of the teaching of you don't want to spoil your children, so if they're screaming, you should just let them scream.
Yeah, that happened to me, too. Yeah. I'd scream because I was hungry and wanted to be held, and my mother felt deeply sorry about this later. She talked to me about it, but at the time, she, like so many women, the doctor was the authority. Mm-hmm. The doctor said, don't spoil him, don't pick him up too much, let him scream, it's good for his lungs. And that, too, contributes to, I think, a deep kind of
our son and how healthily he's come into the world and the healthy person he's grown up to be, in some ways, he did not have the challenges or the yearning to learn. I mean, we really had to, as Don said, learn by the Braille method how to rebirth ourselves, both individually and in our relationship. And there's something that has come in terms of strength that might not have been there had we not had to confront and deal with the level of pain in which we came into this world.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Mm. So, you know, these events obviously happened, and they happened a long time ago, and there's nothing we can do to make them not happen. So what do people do now?
Well, I see the pain, any pain I experience now, I like to think of it as the pain of the little boy, and that an appropriate response is that the loving adult of this moment of now can embrace the hurt little boy. And I believe personally that now has more power and healing than the sum total of all history. Mm. And if I meet my pain of this moment with compassion, then the compassion with which I meet it becomes my reality. And this is not just theory. I really try to practice this in my daily life. And I think it's a good idea to become aware of the way the past has impacted the present, but not to give the past too much power.
Mm. I also find, I'm not wanting to beat a drum, but Don and I have both meditated over the years, and the more that I go into that still, quiet place within, it feels like the past pain tends to recede at some level, that it doesn't have the same grip on me. And my fondest wish is that the stillness that I encounter when I meditate just spread over the entirety of my life, more and more.
Hmm. So for people that this is new to, that may not have a background of what meditation is, or maybe they've tried a various few forms but don't have anything that they've been doing, what's your instruction for people or thoughts?
I think very, very basically, very simply, and this is what I did for years before I came on the particular path that I'm on now, was to find an undisturbed place, sit in a chair or on the floor, and begin to put out an intention. If some people are comfortable with this form, it can be a prayer, that you be able to go within and allow the world, the sense impressions to recede, and just begin watching your breath, just the easy flow up and down of breathing. And the more that I am with my breath, the more space that I have between my thoughts. And I find that in that spaciousness is where my reality lives, where I feel most alive. And so I welcome it. And so I stay with it. And if I have more patience than just 2 minutes, I find that it's like developing a muscle for being comfortable with the stillness.
And I would add, the book does have a section on this, but I would add that I'm really interested in finding out what takes place when I am alive without thinking, without interpreting, and without laying my deep, deep assumptions about who I am and what's going on. And in that stillness, I think there's a great mystery.
Mm. Yeah, there's that interesting teaching that I remember when I was maybe 12, that whole, I think, therefore I am. And for 30 many years, I really, really, truly believed that completely. And it's it's very difficult for me to
undo.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I think you just need a taste of the other.
Mm.
Because it's so, it can be so compelling. You realize when Don and I lived together in Alaska, and we had much more time to explore this, that what I was doing then was so much more potent than the sum total of the rest of my life.
Hmm. So you talk a lot about opening the heart, and that being really important and wonderful, but also challenging at the same time.
Yes.
So how does opening your heart fit into this whole relationship
piece? Well, I would say this, that a person can become very sophisticated psychologically. They can meditate for years. They can learn all the techniques and tools that of communication, nonviolent, and all that. But the bottom line is that unless I'm loving Martha, that if she's not feeling my love, then the whole thing isn't going to work. And that after the early romantic stage is over and resentment sets in, resentment is the closing of the heart, that nothing works until I can learn how to open my heart to my partner, which means let go of my resentment and wish them well. Mm. And I would say that's the great challenge, because you can't just tell a person you should be loving, you should be kind, you should be compassionate and forgiving. It doesn't work. So therefore, what we've come upon is that the reason I close my heart is because fear whispers in my ear its great motto, safety through non-love. Fear tells me, keep my heart closed and that will keep me safe.
Mm.
And the only reason that my non-love persists is because I haven't been sufficiently skeptical. I haven't challenged the voice of fear. So I want to become deeply aware of the beliefs, assumptions, thoughts, attitudes that I hold, perhaps unconsciously, that cause me to close my heart, so I can challenge them. And for me, that's the only way I've found where I can open my closed heart, is to challenge the beliefs that lead to closing it.
So how does someone figure that out? So much of this is, I think, reactionary. I'm assuming, is it awareness over time, or is there...
I'll tell you, Julie, what it was for me, and I think for both of us, was looking at the sum total of our life and seeing how much pain we had had and being really tired of our suffering and seeing that our suffering was coming from one place and one place alone, which was the closing of our heart.
Mm.
I'll tell you one great help for us is when we sat down and realized a very simple truth. The listeners who are in relationship can ask themselves this question. Do I believe that my partner deserves love all the time, no matter what, even when they're doing stuff I don't like? Or do I believe they deserve love when they're behaving the way I want? And, you know, it's easy to give the spiritually correct answer, but then the next question is, do I behave in daily life as if I believe my partner only deserves love some of the time? And most of us, if we're honest, we would say yes.
Hmm.
And so I think it really, really helps for a person to take his or her stand. If I really believe my partner deserves love all the time, that means that when I close my heart to them, I will no longer justify it by pointing to their behavior.
Yeah, we made that decision a few years ago, and it has totally transformed our relationship. It doesn't mean that we're perfect. It doesn't mean that we don't close our heart, you know, to some extent. But whenever one of us does, we don't say, well, my heart's closed because look what he did.
Hmm.
And that alone starts shifting the center of gravity in the relationship.
Because when you don't just, when you don't justify closing your heart, you're no longer watering that noxious weed.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the book, actually, one of the first bullet points here for opening your heart is working on forgiving yourself. So before even getting to the other person and how the other person's involved, it looks like a lot of it is, you know, accepting your closed heart and working on your own forgiveness. And can you talk about that some?
Yeah, sure. I think that I've noticed that when I'm feeling really good about myself, I tend to be quite gracious towards Martha's imperfections.
Hmm.
And I think if you've met people who are very, very judgmental, I think it's pretty obvious that they're very harsh with themselves. I think we tend to judge other people who display traits that remind us of things in ourselves we haven't forgiven. So to me, the tide goes in and out. I work on forgiving Martha by forgiving myself, and I work on forgiving myself by forgiving Martha. I think it goes both ways.
Yeah, and it really underlines what I think is the evolution in consciousness now that's happening, which is to say, you know, at heart, you are no different from me.
Hmm.
We are the same. So how I regard myself is how I will regard you.
Hmm.
There is no separation.
And this notion of how love and pain are so intertwined, in that to love requires openness. Openness makes us vulnerable and susceptible to being hurt, to being to all avenues of pain.
May I respectfully challenge that notion?
Yes, absolutely.
I think that, you know, the word vulnerable does mean two things in English. One is open, as you say, mm-hmm. and the other is capable of being hurt. But I've looked very closely at my own pain over and over again. And while it's true that when I'm open, I am susceptible to pain, that really I think my pain comes not from my love. My pain comes when I take offense at Martha's non-love. Because as I mentioned with a child before, if just think of some time when you've been in pain because Julie hasn't loved you or hasn't been sensitive to your needs. Imagine if you hadn't taken offense at that. Would there be pain?
Interesting way of bringing it back to the self.
In other words, I think the notion that, well, if I'm open, if I'm loving, I have to be open, and if I'm open, that means I can be hurt, is the basic, one of the basic reasons why people are hold back on love and are wary to be loving, because they associate being loving with being hurt. And I think it's a false association at bottom. I think that what makes me hurt is taking offense.
I was taking it, actually, I appreciate your pointing it back at the self, because truly, that's you're absolutely correct. I was going a bit further than it to point out the notion that even with the pain, there's always gain from the experience through it, and that to inhibit ourselves from engaging in a relationship or allowing ourselves to be open for fear of pain inhibits us from all the joy through the other
totally
side.
Agree.
Yeah. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, after being with thousands of dying people, said that the most common thing that she heard from people at the end of their life was that their regret was at not having loved more.
Wow.
Bar none.
Right. So we protect ourselves for the fear.
We protect ourselves. We hold back. And we all do this at some level. And so we need to take an honest look and to try to locate that fear. And maybe it could have been from an earlier decision. I know I made a decision earlier in my life when my brother went into a mental institution. I said, I'm never going to allow myself to be hurt this much again. And I had to relocate that decision to be able to re-decide to open to Don.
How do people balance? Because I think sometimes and Don even mentioned it, we don't necessarily need to dig up every single thing from the past and drudge through it and spend all our time on it. But at the same time, knowing some of those things can be helpful in figuring out why we might be triggered or how we can heal something. So,
I think what it's been is sometimes Martha will do something mild and I will have an emotional response of anger or pain, much greater, way out of proportion to the event that triggered it. And to me, when that happens, that's an indication that the pump in the basement has just kicked in the past. And so what I do is I'll say to myself, does this remind me, does this feeling feel old? Does it feel like it's been around in me for a long time? What does it remind me of? And if I can give an example, Martha once told me when I was being kind of loud socially, she told me to be quiet. And I got so angry. I didn't do anything, but I got enraged, way out of proportion. And what I realized was that I was an intense kid, and my parents were always shushing me up because they were embarrassed by my intensity. And so what Martha said when she was telling me to be quiet reminded me of all the times my parents did it when I was little, and thus my reaction was way off the scale. I think many of us have our own equivalent of something like that. And in a conscious marriage, people will become experts on where their partner's hot buttons are not to walk on eggshells, which is fear's response, but to walk more awarely around those areas.
Conscious marriage. I love that. Mm-hmm. Well, we are almost out of time. I just want to tell people more because we've been so involved in our conversation. I haven't told people halfway through the show who we've been talking to. This is Dawn and Martha Rosenthal, and Learning to Love is their book, From Conflict to Lasting Harmony. And where's the best place that they can get this?
Well, it's just going to be coming out in March in paperback. Barnes & Noble bookstores have it. Amazon will have it. And we also have a website. Am I allowed to say that?
Of course.
AwakeningTogether.com. That's the title of our workshops for couples that we give.
And we will be giving a workshop in the Bay Area in May.
Oh, great.
It'll be on our website.
Great. AwakeningTogether.com.
Excellent. The book, again, is Learning to Love, From Conflict to Lasting Harmony. And you can read more about it and more about Dawn and Martha Rosenthal at AwakeningTogether.com. And I just want to thank you so much for sharing your insights and your many years of wisdom with us and our listeners today. And I can't find a topic, anything really more important than this notion of love and helping each of us to learn more about ourselves and how we ourselves can be more open to love within ourselves and hence to bring that out to others and to the world, and especially to, you know, if we choose to partner up with somebody else, you know, how do we make that happen? How do we make that happen? It seems to be the greatest source of challenge and frustration for us all.
I think it can do a lot of amazing healing for not only ourselves, but the world and the way we respond to each other.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Well, that was exciting. I knew that was going to be a fun show.
Yeah, there really isn't anything more important. So I you know, implore listeners to, you know, go back and listen to the show or just take note or pick up the book, go to their website, and just explore within yourself. I mean, there's a lot of information out there and a lot of people talking about relationships, but the core of any relationship is, you know, what is love and what is love to you and how does it feel and really how do you open up to experience more of it for, you know, whatever that means to you.
And, of course, we know that there is so much disease that is created by not loving ourselves or not being open and connecting with others or feeling that we're alone and isolated. And so much dis-ease and disease can be, I don't know if I want to say balanced, but can be healed through this notion and through this learning experience of learning to love.
I would say that. It can be healed, ameliorated, lessened, because really we know that so much of our dis-ease stems from stress, inhibition. An absence of inhibition, I feel, is what we're talking about when we speak of love.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have been listening to KPOO San Francisco. We are Reality Sandwich. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant.
And I'm Martin Matthews, a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist with Healthful Living. You can read more about Julie and I at healthfulliving.org. This show and all past shows of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com. We'll be back next Thursday at noon. Thanks for listening. Oh, yeah. No, no. Sound.